No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am STD Nora. As you may remember, last week we talked about the plight of the Uyghurs in China, in Xinjiang province specifically. And we talked a bit about the Chinese surveillance of them and how comprehensive it is. And some of you may think that things are very different here, and I think it's true, possibly we'll learn soon, that we don't have the same level of surveillance, but we are surveilled 24/7. And to expand on that, we have with us Arthur Holland Michel. He is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs. He's also the author of Eyes in the Sky, The Secret Rise of Gorgon Stare, and How It Will Watch Us All. And hello to you, Arthur. Thank you for joining us today. And before we get to the issue that we're here to discuss, I'm just curious, what is the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs, and how does one get a job with them?
Well, hi, Esty. It's really wonderful to be here. It's great to see you. So the Carnegie Council is a think tank in New York City, founded by Andrew Carnegie over 100 years ago. And it essentially looks at how to further the consideration of the core ethical principles at the heart of governance. The notion that really when you are forming a society and governing a society and trying to resolve complex issues, you need to keep ethics at the front and center. Keep in mind that the Carnegie Council was founded right after the First World War, when the international community saw that the need for ethics had extremely high stakes. And it's a wonderful organization. I've been involved with them in one way or another, organizing events, speaking at their events since 2013. And at the end of 2019, they approached me and asked if I would be interested in formalizing that relationship a little bit more through a senior fellowship. And so I obviously said yes. It is a wonderful honor. And I, at the Carnegie Council, I focus primarily on issues around artificial intelligence and advanced surveillance technologies, issues that, of course, raise a lot of ethical concerns. And in parallel to that, as you mentioned, I am an author. I published my first book about surveillance technology in 2019, and I'm a journalist and write features about predominantly issues relating to these spooky futures that await us, things related to artificial intelligence, surveillance, and technologies that raise ethical concerns.
Mm-hmm. So the spooky future, but also the spooky present, isn't it? What about my statement just a couple of minutes ago that we are being surveilled 24/7? Is that correct, or am I overstating it?
No, not at all. I think it's an absolutely fair statement. We have some awareness of this, that we now live in a quote-unquote surveillance society, but the degree to which we are surveilled and the persistence with which we are surveilled and the variety of ways in which we are surveilled has exploded in the last sort of, say, decade and a half. That is partly as a result of all the CCTV cameras that now watch almost every square inch of public space in towns ones, large and small, but also, of course, some of the technologies that we might not think about all the time, things like automated license plate readers, which, you know, track every vehicle that enters or passes through a particular checkpoint. You know, these technologies are there, they're out there. Systems that can detect our location just by, you know, from the information that's passed up from our smartphones, and of course social media, which has been described as the greatest surveillance technology ever created. So no, you're absolutely on the money. It's fair to say that we are being watched in some way or another 24/7 wherever we are, unless you're in the middle of the woods and you have no electronic devices, and even then maybe there's a satellite that has a ping on you.
I want to take just a quick digression because you and I talked about getting vaccinated just before we started here. And I know that a lot of the people who decidedly are not going to get vaccinated is because they think there is a chip in the vaccine that will make sure that they know where you are at all times. And it occurs to me that there is a chip in that phone that we all carry on us in some way or another pretty much 24/7. Is there a need for a chip in our bodies, or are we?
No, absolutely not. It would be to say it would be overkill is to put it mildly. You know, if a person is truly concerned about being surveilled, they should get off Facebook. They should get off Twitter. They should probably give away their computer. They should definitely give away their smartphone and only use a landline. They probably shouldn't use a credit card. They probably don't want to have a car because cars can be tracked. And they probably don't want to spend that much time in cities that have a lot of CCTV cameras. So I can assure you, if the government wants to watch you, they already have ample ways to do so without having to put a microchip into your bloodstream, which, by the way, would obviously be impossible as well, even if they did want to do it.
Yeah, well, and it seems like even if they don't want to watch you, they are watching you, right? So if you are a model citizen, you've never done anything, but at some point they think that maybe you have or maybe you will, which is another issue here, they can go back and find out everything about you that they've accumulated. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We leave a permanent digital trace. Mm-hmm. I was shocked, for example, to learn that in New York City and in many other cities that are adopting these same kinds of database management systems, I know that sounds kind of geeky, but you'll see why it's important in a second, that in a lot of these cities, any police officer can search your name and not only find your arrest record, if you have one, or a record of your prior delinquencies, but every call that you have made to the 311 service, let's say, I don't know, the trash isn't being picked up on your street and you want to file a complaint. Well, that goes in your permanent record. If you call the police because of someone else, to report a crime by someone else, that will go into your record. If you are a witness, that will go into your record. Anytime you've had a parking ticket, right? And these might not seem in isolation to be particularly significant little pieces of evidence, but together they can tell a pretty detailed story about your past. So no, even if you're a model citizen, you still leave an extensive trail of digital breadcrumbs. It's just a question of whether someone wants to look into your history and has a reason to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, so as I was listening to the motto of my show, no change without struggle, no one in power ain't giving up nothing, which is so relevant to almost everything that we talk about on this show. But I was thinking how this change, the change from us being kind of more or less autonomous people to us being data, and surveilled data, as has happened pretty much without struggle. And, you know, I've been doing this show for many years, and I remember talking about technologies that were coming at the time and have become everyday occurrences by now. For example, you can't get your a new driver's license without putting your eyes to this little machine that doesn't seem like much, but that captures your irises, and that's one way they can identify you. I don't remember any struggle on the way to that being implemented, even though there were some of us in the media who were talking about it and trying to inform people. Has there been, or do you feel that it really, this is a revolution that has happened behind our backs and without most of us noticing?
You know, it really has happened in a kind of behind the scenes way. I would call it a quiet revolution. I think people are to some extent aware, but it's death by a thousand cuts. It isn't one single scary giant eye in the sky that everybody can see and point to and that serves as a physical emblem of the surveillance state, something that's an easy target of a struggle, if you will. You know, it's really the accumulation of many different, often invisible devices. And the fact that you say that it is a quiet revolution, something that has been hard to perceive, is what keeps me going. It's what gets me up in the morning, because that's why I write about these things. Because if people don't write about them, then they will continue to be operated, they will continue to expand. You know, and another reason, if you will, that there hasn't been so much of a struggle, if you will, public attention, is because these technologies operate often in loopholes in privacy law. So, you know, there are privacy protections that are embedded in U.S. law, but for the most part, they were written decades before these technologies existed. So police are not allowed, for example, to tap your phone unless they have a court order, unless they have a warrant. Now, that comes from a law that was passed, you know, I mean, the process that began in the sort of early 20th century. The law was passed in the 1930s. But of course, you know, if a police officer wanted to follow you now, or if they wanted information about your life, they could probably just look on Twitter, right? And apply some data analytics. And of course, a law that was written in the 1930s would say nothing about social media or data analytics. And so there hasn't been a process. In many cases, law enforcement is able to acquire these technologies in secret. And for me, and we can get to this a little later in more detail, but it all comes back to transparency. Because if people don't know that this stuff is happening, as you point out, then there is no way to struggle, there is no way to ask questions about it, and there is no way to have an open debate as to whether we actually want these systems watching us 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I appreciate you being with us and allowing us the opportunity to talk about this. Again, my guest is Arthur Holland Michel, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs, the author of Eyes in the Sky, The Secret Rise of Gorgon Stare and How It Will Watch Us All. And I invited him because I read his extensive article in Wired magazine titled "The Spying Eyes Everywhere, and Now They Share a Brain." Wired, by the way, for our listeners and for you, Arthur, is a magazine with some really amazing writing and a lot of really, really good information. And then they also, it seems like in every issue, they have some extensive article that is all about how great the military is, or the FBI, or the police, which I find very interesting. Do you want to comment on that? You don't have to.
No, I mean, you know, gadgetry is cool. You know, there are sometimes cool stories to be told in gadgetry that can feel a little bit celebratory. But Wired is also very open to hard-hitting journalism about the dangers of all of these same technologies. So there's a nice balance there.
Yeah. It's really, I recommend the magazine. I find it just fascinating. So partially, or, you know, to a large degree, you write, you explain in the article how it came to be as it is currently. What has been the process that got us thus far? And we can talk also about the future later.
Sure. So you'll recall from earlier in the conversation, we talked about all these different surveillance technologies that are watching us 24/7. And I ran through the list. Well, previously, and in many cases still today, each of these systems generates its own sort of island of data. So the video cameras that watch you, they each send a video feed to an individual TV monitor that is in some police station somewhere. The social media data that is pulled off your phone is downloaded into the cloud, probably. Your arrest record, your criminal record, the whole city record that the law enforcement has on you is in another database. And if a law enforcement agency wants to piece those pieces of information together to figure out who you are or what you're doing, which really is what detective work is all about. A detective never solves a case by just looking at one piece of information. They see that a person appeared on the video camera at one place, and it was at exactly the same time that they tweeted about something, that they had a beef with somebody and they wanted to kill them, and they put those pieces of information together and they crack the case. Well, previously doing that, what is called in the field information fusion, fusing disparate pieces of information, was a very labor-intensive task. It involved going through paper files, going on different computers, knowing what to search for, knowing, you know, what time things happened. It took enormous teams and enormous resources and effort. Well, what I write about in the article is a new set of, in many cases, artificially intelligent systems that can do that fusion in an automatic way. So to put it in practice, what does that mean? Let's say that there is a 911 call that a police station receives that there has been a shooting somewhere in the city. Well, the law enforcement agency with this technology can essentially go on the computer. They have a map of the city and they can click on that exact place where that reported crime happened. And then they click a button, which in some cases is literally called the quote unquote investigate button. And the artificial intelligence, the algorithms, will find everything from all of those different databases, all of those different sources of surveillance that might be relevant to that crime. So when I got a demonstration of this system, it showed every single person within a several block radius of that reported crime who had an arrest record. It showed images of every single vehicle that was seen leaving the scene of the crime. It showed all the police cars that were nearby. It showed a list of similar crimes that had been reported in that area in previous weeks. If you then clicked on any one of those quote unquote tips that the AI system is giving you, it does exactly the same thing all over again. It shows you which people were nearby at the time of that previous crime, who they are associated with, what their arrest record is, what they look like, you know, what kind of vehicle they drive. And so in doing that, what was previously a very, very tedious job of putting together the puzzle from all of these different surveillance systems becomes a click of a button. It is literally the artificial intelligence doing the investigation for you. And that raises all sorts of really interesting and difficult questions that we can get into. But I'll just leave it at that to give you the sort of sense of what technology we are talking about.
Well, so let me take the devil's advocate position and say, that's great. If crimes can be solved quicker and better, what is wrong with that? That's fantastic.
It's true. And it's very, very hard to argue with that logic. You know, often when I'm reporting on these types of technologies, the example that is always given to me is an abduction in process. So a child gets snatched from a playground and you have literally minutes to stop that from happening, to intercept the person before they disappear. And if you have the capacity to do so, using these new technologies, you almost have a responsibility to do it. But really, that is a little bit of a distraction from the fact that these technologies are not only used for tracking down child abductions. And in fact, the core of the problem is the ease with which this surveillance can happen now. Previously, if you wanted to surveil someone in this way, if you wanted to piece together their whole life history, you really needed to want it, because you were going to have to get a whole team of detectives, a whole team of people to follow that person around. You were going to need to invest a lot of money. It was going to take a lot of time. But because now it is so easy, because you can do it at the click of a button, the threshold suddenly gets much, much lower. And suddenly there is this slippery slope effect where the law enforcement agency that bought this system initially for those occasional instances of child abductions is now using it to follow protesters home from a peaceful demonstration, to get the permanent record of a person who, I don't know, what's some minor infringement, I don't know, put the trash out on the wrong day of the week. And suddenly we all become targets because it's so easy and because there is always going to be someone who has some reason to watch someone else in society. So in these circumstances, nobody is safe. And that's the problem. How you differentiate the cases where this technology really should be used from the cases where it definitely shouldn't.
Mm-hmm. We do actually have a caller for you already, Arthur. Dan, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the chilling topic. We've been talking a lot about governmental use of these technologies. I'm wondering about private control of these technologies, of this information, and what corporations, for instance, are doing with it. And I'll specifically think about Amazon and its current union busting efforts. What is it doing along those lines? It has access to all this information about people and their activities. So I wonder if your guests could expand on that a little about private entities and what they're doing. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
And I'm sure you can. Thank you, Dan. Go ahead, Arthur.
Thanks, Don. No, it's a phenomenal question, and the short answer is yes. In many cases, private entities have access to extraordinary amounts of information about us. I mean, in some cases, they have access to information that law enforcement agencies could only dream of having. And we know that to be the case because companies like Apple and Facebook and Amazon are constantly getting requests from law enforcement to open up people's iPhones or to get access into the sort of the back end database of this user's behavior, because that is information that law enforcement doesn't have on its own. And you're absolutely right to bring up the concern about the misuse of these technologies in private hands, because at a minimum, law enforcement does actually have some constitutional guardrails on what it can and cannot do. Now, in many cases, these new technologies have kind of degraded those protections because of those loopholes that I mentioned earlier. But in the case of private entities, a lot of those restrictions do not apply. You know, if a company wants to piece together your whole record and find where you live and who you associate with and what religious beliefs you might have, you know, certainly initially the idea with these companies, their motivation for that data collection was to sell you more products and to keep you online for longer. Now, that alone comes with all sorts of ethical concerns. But now the real worry that I have is exactly as you mentioned, Don, that these companies have a growing temptation and a motivation to use this enormous amount of data to retain their power, because they obviously have become so immensely powerful, and that power comes with a certain level of fragility that is threatened by causes like unionization. And that to me feels like a really dangerous situation, where you have companies that want to keep us from changing the policies about them, that want to prevent us from challenging them, and they know everything about us. I encourage everybody who thinks about the surveillance issue to not only look at government surveillance, but to look at private entity surveillance as well. Something that was already raising all sorts of concerns just when this was for purely, you know, for getting people to stay online longer, but now is actually becoming weaponized in a really terrifying way. One last thing I'll say about that is that one of the issues that I've encountered in my reporting that speaks to the exact crossover between private and public is that one of the most valuable sources of information now for law enforcement agencies is what are called location databases. And that is, when you have a smartphone and you have an app, chances are that app is sending your location information at every couple of minutes to a big database. And mostly private entities use this to sell you products that are relevant to, you know, your location. So you live in Madison and it sends you ads based on the fact that you live in Madison for a great restaurant there in your neighborhood. Okay, so be it. But now evidence is starting to emerge that law enforcement agencies and the military have begun buying these location data sets. And with these location data sets, they can find out everywhere a person has been, sometimes going back many, many years, and can, with the advent of these technologies, these fusion technologies, combine that with everything else that they have about you. And with the addition of each new source of information, the whole sum of it becomes more intrusive and more powerful. Again, it's not a cheery picture, but these are things that we do need to be talking about.
Yeah, and on top of all of that, there's the issue of biases, both in the software itself and in those who are interpreting it, and bad cops who are out there to get certain kinds of people. There's human error. The New York Times recently had an article about three men, all of them black, not related to each other in any way, who were all arrested for crimes that they didn't commit because the facial recognition decided that they were that person. Yeah. What about these things?
No, it's a huge concern, and it's something that people aren't talking about enough. So when I was given a private demonstration of this technology, the technology that does the automatic investigation, we clicked on the scene of the crime on this big map. It looks very much like Google Maps. And the system gave us a list of all the people nearby who had criminal records. Now, we were, quote unquote, investigating a very, very serious crime, a potential shooting. So you really, really want to catch the people responsible. And when you are given a list of people who have criminal records who were near the scene of a crime, you immediately, subconsciously put two and two together and suspect those people, even though there is a very good possibility that they didn't have anything to do with it. They were just in the wrong place in the wrong time. It is confirming the biases that we already have. Now, you know, because previously surveillance was much more time consuming and tedious, you couldn't just go down any rabbit hole for any lead that you wanted to based on any whim or bias that you might have. You kind of had to choose your battles. You weren't just going to investigate all 100 people that happened to live near the scene of a crime. You were going to select those who had the highest probability of being the suspect that you are looking for. But because you can automate this, you can act on your biases in an automatic way, in a very, very easy way. And this is problematic because, well, one, we know that criminal records are themselves biased data sets. They reflect the fact that African American and other people of color are disproportionately caught up in the criminal justice system. And so the criminal record that exists disproportionately reflects those demographic groups. And with these technologies today, as I mentioned at the beginning, the record becomes completely permanent. So if you have one criminal record on your rap sheet, you will appear every time that the computer does an investigation. Mm-hmm. And so those biases become perpetuated, right? It becomes a snowball effect. And you're absolutely right. It's a tremendous concern and something that sadly people also aren't talking about.
Yeah, and you also mentioned in your article, I don't know if that was the same time that you had an opportunity to actually work one of these apps, but you chose to look at the victim of a crime, and you received all kinds of really personal information that you felt you really shouldn't have seen. Talk about
that. Yeah, it's true. So I was in New York City, and I was with someone who works for the New York Police Department. This person gave me their smartphone, which was loaded with the app that could do these kind of automatic investigations, and said, "Go ahead, play around with it. You know, search whoever you like." And it was a kind of strange moment. A bunch of names just, you know, popped into my head because it's like this incredible superpower.
Hate, right?
Yeah, I mean, friends, you know, enemies, former lovers. I mean, the temptations there were astonishing, but I kind of took a deep breath and controlled myself and ended up searching for an individual who was shot and luckily survived in Brooklyn in 2014 in a case that I reported on for an earlier project. And it was incredible, instantaneously, just searching this person's name. I'd never met this person, by the way. I was given a whole archive right on that smartphone of that person's full record. You know, if that person had a car, I can't remember exactly if that was the case. I could even see a map showing all the places in New York City where that person tended to congregate, a kind of heat map showing, you know, the areas where they liked to spend the most time, in addition to absolutely anything else that you can imagine. And I was overcome by this terrifying feeling by how easy it was to access information that I certainly didn't feel like I had any right to see. And I wasn't even sure that a curious police officer had the right to see that information. There was no need for a warrant, right? No court order, no basis of reasonable suspicion. It was just the click of a button. It was a really impacting moment that I will not soon forget.
Mm-hmm. My guest is, I was going to say author. You are an author. Author Arthur Holland Michel. He's, besides being an author, he's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. And he authored Eyes in the Sky, The Secret Rise of Gorgon Stare, and How It Will Watch Us All. So many questions I still have for you, Dan, and Arthur, and so little time, but so I invited people to join us on social media, and you have mentioned social media a number of times, and I think maybe the most striking thing about it is that we do it voluntarily. we put our stuff on social media, and I think all of us know that it's being surveilled. Talk about that, and what are the implications of that, and the possible implications. Let's say if Trump will steal the president, and it became criminal to not support Trump. Mm-hmm. What would be my fate, for example?
It's a little hard to hypothesize about that. I'll take your question.
Not necessary.
I'll zoom out a little bit on your question.
All right.
That what I've observed in recent years is a profound change in our relationship with social media. You know, I started using Facebook as a teenager. That'll age me a little. In 2005, 2006. And at the time, our relationship with these technologies was one of pure optimism. And I remember that we would voluntarily tag our friends in pictures that we took because we just thought it was cool. We didn't really even know why we did it. But the what we didn't realize at the time was that tagging was actually helping Facebook develop what has become one of the most powerful facial recognition systems in the world. It has taken a really long time. I got a Facebook in 2011. Some people, it's taken a little bit longer, but it's taken a really long time. But now people realize that what we put on social media is one, not only a permanent record, but two, it has all sorts of political ramifications. It has a political and social dimension that is permanent and which is open and which elicits all sorts of emotions and which puts us on the sides of debates that we don't necessarily want to align with. It is wrapped up in all sorts of questions around political power. So we know, not quite yet from the United States, but in other countries, in Thailand, for example, you can be imprisoned for, you know, criticizing the monarchy on social media. So we're realizing that actually maybe that tremendous optimism that we used to have about social media was misplaced. One, because it gave rise to these very powerful companies that, as our dear caller Don mentioned, have now all sorts of information about us. But two, has contributed to political divisions and has become an instrument not only of division but also of power. And yes, you can hypothesize that in some perhaps not too distant future, there could be serious ramifications for tweeting the wrong thing. I mean, there already are in a social sense, but that could be codified. I'm very worried about it. It's not exactly my area of expertise, but the good news is that people are starting to wake up to these facts. The fact that you're asking me this question shows that people are waking up to these issues, and that gives me hope.
Yeah. Well, we have two callers waiting to talk with you, so let's get to Rich. Hi, Rich, you're on the air.
Hi. You two will tell me whether or not this fits, but another side to this is that when the private citizen seeks information about government activities, there's a Freedom of Information Act, but according to an author, Nicholson Baker, whose new book, Baseless, My Search for Information in the Ruins of Freedom of Information Act, wrote, the Freedom of Information Act for private citizens seeking out information about governmental activities is like a farce. You're charged money, you're given these delayed schedules where something you requested 10 or 20 years ago is never revealed to you. And I'm wondering if that fits within this conversation.
It absolutely does.
An interesting question. Go ahead, Arthur.
Yeah, no, thank you, Rich. I appreciate the question. It's very important. So for those callers who are perhaps a little, those listeners who are perhaps a little less familiar, there is a law in this country, the Freedom of Information Act, that states that the public has a right to demand information from the government that isn't public. and you, there's a whole process. Different agencies handle it differently. In some cases, you just fill out an online form. You say what you're asking for. So I'm looking, I don't know, for the FBI's information on any programs that they have on, you know, automated fusion technologies, because I'm writing an article about it. And then, as Rich points out, it can become a real comedy of errors, actually trying to get them to respond to this Freedom of Information Act. The government, as they see it, have to toe this very, very narrow line between providing information in the public interest, but also protecting state secrets. And all too often, there is a strong temptation on the part of the government to claim that everything is a secret, even though, as we often know, things that one, you know, are called secrets actually are not that secretive and shouldn't be secretive. But two, that there is a public gain in having this information be public. And obviously, different people, that becomes a matter of opinion. Now, because the Freedom of Information Act is subject to interpretation in many cases, it can become really, really difficult to get that information. And as the state becomes more securitized, and as there is just more volume of data that the state wants to keep private and keep classified, then yes, there is a possibility that the Freedom of Information Act will be eroded further. I probably wouldn't go so far as to say that it's in shambles and that it has no purpose now. Freedom of Information Act requests generate every day tremendous amounts of information that are really, really valuable and that spur public conversations, and that continues to be the case. But it is an important conversation that people need to be having, to how to, you know, bolster that element of the law to make sure that it doesn't get completely eroded. So great question, Rich. Really appreciate it.
And also so interesting that as they know more and more about us, we can know less and less about them, which I think is very scary.
Absolutely. No, there should be more balance, right? In what we know about each other. Interestingly, there are technologies that we can use to find out more about government activities. There are all these, you know, you might call them desktop investigators that use social media to do what is called surveillance. So surveillance against the people who are conducting surveillance on us. New technologies enable citizens to do that kind of thing at grand scale, but it's still completely asymmetrical, and transparency helps find a balance there.
Uh-huh. Well, Joanne, you're on the air.
Yes, great show. Computer systems developers and researchers at Google and Facebook have protested about some of the facial recognition applications to which their research is being put. And I'm wondering what you think of as the future for such kinds of disruption, whether or not the people who could be real heroes in the future and alert us are the very people who are creating those technologies. And these are folks who can get jobs elsewhere. You know, they've got some leeway in terms of their employment. If they quit, it can make a big difference in projects.
Absolutely. It's a really concerning set of developments. A dear caller, Joanne, is referring to a number of recent cases where ethics officers at some of these large companies quit in protest, not only because of facial recognition, but also because of the development of all kinds of AI technologies that raise ethical concerns. And yes, it's true. You know, once there is that there is no longer that one ethical voice in the room, then all those guardrails are removed. I'd encourage you, if I can shamelessly self-promote a little bit, to take a look at a recent event that we had at the Carnegie Council called the Societal Limits of AI Ethics. And really what we got at in that event with three wonderful speakers was that in many cases, these companies, they don't want their technologies to be truly, truly ethical in the way that you or I might understand ethics in society, because that hurts their bottom line. And that's why voices like these engineers who you're referring to, these ethicists who are inside the companies, are so, so valuable and so fragile and so precious. So when we see that these folks are being fired or they leave in protest, it's a moment to wake up and say, oh, okay, that means there's no one in the room anymore. Let's make sure that that person gets replaced, that there are processes in place to ensure that those people are protected and to ensure that this development doesn't just run wild.
Mm-hmm. And Eric, you're on the air.
Hello. It seems like this data collection is pretty inevitable, and there are certain best practices, I understand, that can be taken, like limiting social media, closed source software, that kind of a thing. But since it seems inevitable until legislation gets passed, what can we do to perhaps intentionally feed bad data into the collection and basically poison the data they have on us?
Yeah. You know, it's so what our dear caller Eric is referring to is the, this notion of data poisoning, which is a bit of a weak spot for AI systems. If AI systems are wholly dependent on good data, if they get fed bad data, data that's incorrect or incomplete, for example, or false, then they're not going to work as well. I wish I had a more specific answer for you, Eric, but the challenge here is that it's actually quite hard to know how to poison data if you don't know the architecture of the AI system itself. You know, there are two types of quote-unquote poisoning attacks on AI systems. There are white box attacks. These are the ones where the attacker knows how the AI system works, and therefore they know how to poison it most effectively. Those are, of course, the more effective types of attacks. But, you know, no one has access to Facebook's algorithms on the outside. It's a little hard to do that. The other option is a black box attack, where you essentially make a best guess as to how to trip up these AI systems, these algorithms. And that's a little bit more of a sort of guessing game, you know, the spin the wheel, if you will. But, you know, if you don't want the to be surveilled, then increasingly there are ways to opt out, right? Read extensively that huge document of terms and conditions that you have to agree to before downloading an app, for example. You'll be surprised how much information is in that document about how you are going to be watched as a result of having this this app on your phone. And if you don't like it, don't use the app. It's that simple. Find another app that doesn't have those policies. They do exist. And in terms of the government side, for me, the solution is always transparency. I do not want to advocate people, you know, poisoning government data. I think that goes down a pretty dangerous path. Go to your town council. Find out what they are and are not doing in terms of surveillance. Find out about what their budget is for surveillance. Tell them if you think that they shouldn't be surveilling you this way. You know, the more you can engage, the more you can encourage transparency, the more we can set some of those guardrails without going down a sort of spy versus spy route of cat and mouse with poisoning data and this, that, and the other. It's best if the systems aren't abused in the first place. Use Freedom of Information Act requests, for example, and write to your local representative, because it's an issue that they should be interested in if they're not already.
Mm-hmm. Well, our city council, we have very little time, but our city council or a committee within the city council came up with recommendations against surveillance. I don't know what stage we are at. Maybe Shelly, who is our engineer today, maybe she knows and can let us know. But I wonder, even if we are successful, there still are all kinds of other eyes watching us that are not our city. It's
absolutely.
It's a very limited. You know, go ahead.
I appreciate the question, because in sort of working to maintain privacy in our age, there's no end goal. It's going to be an ongoing process. So you win battles, some battles, you lose some battles, you get ordinances passed at the town council level, maybe you write to your state senator and they pass something at the state level, maybe even at the federal level. But the technology is not stopping. The interest in using these surveillance devices is not stopping. The people are going to continue to come up with clever ways to use these technologies. And so it's an ongoing discussion. You know, maybe as Charlie points out, a city bans facial recognition, but there's going to be a new technology that comes down the road in a couple of years. So, you know, don't just focus on one end game. Make sure that the process is ongoing and that we support the process by remaining engaged through till the very end. And there is no end, as long as we can.
And of course, you know, using so much surveillance is also a tool of scaring the citizenry, right? So people are afraid to do what they need to do to slow down. And I'm saying slow down because I don't think it can be stopped. But anything about that?
Yeah, certainly. you know, we don't want to get to a point where people are penalized just for going to their town council and expressing their views, right? And fortunately, in the United States, we're not yet at that point. But it could get to that point if we're not careful, if these technologies do get further out of hand. So my advice is to take advantage of the fact that there are these freedoms today to ensure that we never get to that point, because there are definite dangers that can and should be prevented now, and we really don't have the luxury of time to wait.
Yeah. Well, and Charlie also added that there are certain approved uses for law enforcement, like to track down sex trafficking, probably the child abduction, which has become such a big trope. It doesn't happen very often, but
no,
we're all so afraid of it all the time. Well, Arthur, I have so many more questions for you. We're going to have you again in a few months. I really appreciate you joining us today. Arthur Holland-Michel is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. He's the author of Eyes in the Sky, The Secret Rise of Gorgon Stare and How It Will Watch Us All. And we haven't even talked about your book, so we'll have to have you again. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
It would be my pleasure. Thank you, Esty. All the best.
Great. And thanks to Shally Pittman, our news director, and to their engineer, and to Richelle, our producer. I'm Esty Dinor. Bye bye, you all. We come and listen and support it. Live in the we come and never.